Israel actually plans to exterminate the entire Arab Muslim population of the world. And the Muslims know this. And this is why their jihadism and their excesses have some basis in reality. They're trying to survive because they know that Israel simply is interested only in genocide and exterminating all the Arab people, bringing them under complete domination. And the Israelis are always exterminationists.
Are they creating a Christian-Muslim war?
Yes. That's all deliberate. See, there is no Christian-Muslim war. Now, I have filed legal papers in this town here before in a law case that I have going on, in which I say frankly that 1 billion Christians and 1 billion Muslims are now at a war to the death with each other, and the only victor will be the state of Israel, because Israel is getting rid of all of its rivals and all of its competitors at one fell swoop. It's a brilliant move, and it's also totally calculated and ruthless.
Is the real enemy Israel?
Yeah. Or Zionism, world Zionism. The state of Israel is nothing. It never has been. It's the tiniest state in the world, yet this is the most important state in the world. It's the most important state to the entire United States government because they put the interests of Israel before every other consideration, including the United States. Well, Ezra is the dominant intellectual of the 20th century, and four of his proteges have been named given the Nobel Prize for Literature after he edited the work. And the first one is T.S. Eliot. He first edited his poem, The Wasteland, in 1920 in Paris, and that became the most famous poem of the 20th century. It's not mentioned very much today, but in the 30s and 40s, every college student could recite The Wasteland. And that's how young men would pick up girls, is by talking about The Wasteland. They'd get interested and go to a bar and have sex. So it was very useful. And after The Wasteland, he became Ernest Hemingway's mentor, and he edited Ernest Hemingway, and he made Hemingway's prose very crisp. And Hemingway had been a hack newspaper writer for a firm called, it was a newspaper called the Moose Jaw Herald in Saskatchewan, Canada. That was his stellar background to become a writer. And so Pound took his material and tightened it up, and he just had a knack for doing that. He could edit anybody's. See, the people, his proteges were all very dissimilar people. T.S. Eliot was a very stuffy Harvard graduate. Ernest Hemingway was a doctor's son from Chicago. His father committed suicide, and he committed suicide when he was 61, and I think one of his sons has committed suicide. So they have a knack for it. And so that was two of his proteges. And then William Butler Yeats is one is in all the anthologies. When Pound met William Butler Yeats in London. He was a very, very famous poet at that time, but he was writing stuffy Victorian poetry. And so Ezra was horrified by that, and he got him totally out of that and into more modern poetry. And so he became much more famous, and he got the Nobel Prize for that. And then his fourth protege was James Joyce, who wrote Ulysses, one of the most famous books of the 20th century. And Pound edited that, and James Joyce was a terrible writer, and he edited his prose, and that became the most famous book of the 20th century. It was Ulysses was the Bible of the 1930s. Everybody talked about it. And so there was four Nobel Prizes for literature from one writer. It's the only time in history that a writer has ever had one protege get the Nobel Prize for literature. And by coincidence, I'm his last living protege. They're all dead, long gone except me. And so I'm patiently waiting my turn. And Ezra Pound himself was never named for the Nobel Prize, although four of his pupils were, simply because he never cultivated the establishment. He never, well, in the 1930s and 1940s, you really had to be a very active, outspoken pro-communist to get anywhere. So, of course, he was totally ignored by everybody, except the public. The public liked his work. And his novels were all bestsellers. They made a movie of For Whom the Bell Tolls. That's the most famous book. But he actually wrote some others that were quite good. So Ezra had these four proteges who had got the Nobel Prize when I met him. And he really jumped on me and started whipping me into shape. And he assigned me to go to the Library of Congress and see what I could find out about the Federal Reserve System. Well, I really had a knack for research, and I found out the entire history of the Federal Reserve System, which is the greatest swindle ever known in history, where a group of private bankers conspired criminally to take over the money and credit of the United States, which they did in 1913, and they passed the Federal Reserve plan through the Democratic Party in Washington, D.C., and it became a law of Congress. And this law handed over to this private bank all of the money and credit of the United States, which was a pretty good day's work. And they've kept it ever since, because they set it up as a monopoly so that the stock of the Federal Reserve banks could never be traded publicly. It could only be handed down in a family, or if a corporation bought the bank that owned it, they became possessors of the stock. You've never been able to buy, since 1914, you've not been able to buy a share of Federal Reserve Bank stock on the market anywhere. And that is monopoly. That's what they have. It's a monopoly. You see, they're totally insulated against anyone buying control of the Federal Reserve System. And John D. Rockefeller is one of the biggest holders, and he had his stock placed under the Rockefeller Foundation, so it can never be bought or sold. So it's secure forever. And the other people who bought control in 1914, they were the Schiff family and the Warburg family. And of course, they still have their own family fortunes, and they have a controlling interest in Federal Reserve Bank stock, in various Federal Reserve banks. It's not all in one Federal Reserve Bank. It's in a number of Federal Reserve banks. And so, I think most of the holders of the Federal Reserve Bank have at least stock in at least five of the Federal Reserve banks.
What are the consequences of having the Federal Reserve control the monetary system of the United States?
Well, the consequences are very important, and they're never discussed by any economist in the United States. The Federal Reserve Bank is a central bank. And a central bank, this is not taught in any economics class in the United States or in the world. A central bank is a bank of issue, which has the right to print all the money it wants. That's what a bank of issue means. You can print all the money you want. There's no control over it whatsoever. And right now, the Federal Reserve Bank is printing trillions of dollars, which are almost worthless, and they're looking for hyperinflation, actually, because it'll be a repeat of 1924 in Germany. But I think they've taken some precautions. It probably won't happen, because they've been through all that. They know exactly what will happen. And in hyperinflation, the money becomes worthless to the point where you have to have a wheelbarrow full of currency, paper currency, to buy a loaf of bread, which is normally worth 18 cents at that time. So they don't want to go through that again, so they're taking care of that. But the Federal Reserve has printed so much of this paper fiat currency, debt money, that it's overloaded the world. China and Japan have trillions of dollars of our so-called national debt, which is our currency. And of course, they know that when it goes, it goes. When a currency becomes worthless, nothing's more worthless than a currency that becomes worthless. So they're staving off the inevitable by hedging and doing what they can. But once you buy this debt, this paper dollar currency, you're stuck with it unless you can find another sucker to take it off your hands. And there's nobody right now who wants any part of it. So China and Japan are stuck with it. And they bought this currency to maintain trade with the United States. That's all it was for. So in effect, we're financing our trade with China, trade with Japan by our Federal Reserve currency, which is neither federal. It's not federal any more than the Federal Express Company is a federal company. And it has no reserves because it doesn't need any reserves because it prints its own currency. If you could print your own money, what do you need of reserves? You're just going to warm up the printing press and turn out another $10 billion. So, finally, it's not a system. It's called the Federal Reserve System. It's not federal. It has no reserves. And it's not a system, but I'm the only person in the world who's ever defined it in my works as a criminal syndicate. And that's what it is. It's a criminal syndicate, just like the Mafia, which is one of its subsidiaries, and the CIA and all the criminal syndicates work out of the Federal Reserve System. Because that's what a Federal Reserve System is. A central bank is a group of bankers which have total control of a nation's economy. And they print their own money, print as much as they want to, and it eventually becomes worthless and through speculation. See, a central bank is set up for speculation. The Federal Reserve System was set up solely for speculation, and its author, Paul Warburg, who was a partner of Kuhnloeb Company in New York, which, by the way, financed the Communist Revolution, financed the Hitler Revolution, and financed the Japanese entry into World War II. So I defined in my work that a central bank's principal role is for war finance, because war finance is the most profitable enterprise you can get into. And so if you're a banker, you're looking for the best investment you can make, which is a war. For instance, the Iraq War. Now, when they set up the Iraq War, Halliburton and company, which is the oil production company, or an oil equipment company, actually, but it finances the big oil explorations. And they found out that, oil companies found out that a war is the most profitable investment you can have. During World War I, Rockefeller, out of his patriotic goodwill, upped the price of oil five times to the U.S. government. That's how we won the war. And that's how he became, he was already the richest man in the world. And the richest man in the world wants to become the richest man in the universe, which is your next step, and apparently he made that. So that's when it comes. People wonder why a billionaire wants more money. Now, H.L. Hunt's sons and four sons, each one of them started off life at 21 with $1 billion at that time. And as you can imagine, they haven't thrown it away. So they were, on paper, they're worth about $2 billion apiece at the present time. But who knows what their holdings are.
How is the Federal Reserve set up?
Well, it was set up as 12 districts. See, we had 48 states in the United States at that time. So you would think that the logical way would be to set up a Federal Reserve Bank in each state and have the 48 Federal Reserve Banks. But instead, they carved the United States into 12 districts of their own, which they called Federal Reserve Districts. And these 12 Federal Reserve Districts are actually the government of the United States. They override the states, and they override the federal government. And not many people know that. They don't know that this is the Federal Reserve System of the United States. the Federal Reserve districts.
Why didn't the American people rise up or say something about it?
They didn't say anything about it because it was a hidden conspiracy. Now I'm always called a conspiratologist, and people say I see conspiracies everywhere. But as I told a reporter for the Dallas Morning News a couple years ago in a front page story, I said I've never had to invent a conspiracy in my life. There are more conspiracies than I can possibly write about. So it's not a question of seeing conspiracies under every bed. It's a question of seeing conspiracies in every commercial activity and every political activity that goes on in this country. Because they always have a hidden agenda, which means that the conspirators have to keep their identities concealed. And it's always criminal in nature because they always have some criminal objective to obtain by operating this conspiracy. That makes all persons involved in a conspiracy for a criminal purpose automatically become criminals, criminally liable. And that is the case of everybody who has anything to do with the Federal Reserve System. They're criminally liable for participating in a criminal conspiracy. And there's no other definition that you can make because under law, a person who is involved in a criminal conspiracy is a criminal. And that's the upshot of the whole thing. There's nothing more to be said.
Why doesn't Congress control the money?
Well, Thomas Jefferson and the writers of the Constitution specifically designated the Congress to control the money. And they designated that the monetary unit of the United States would be gold and silver. There is no specification anywhere in the Constitution for paper money. And what the Federal Reserve conspiracy of 1913 did, it made lawful a paper currency which the Constitution did not authorize. But they passed it through Congress, so it became public law of Congress, and that made it official that the Federal Reserve dollar became the monetary unit of the United States as paper currency, which totally defied the Constitution, which provided that only gold and silver could be the monetary unit of the United States, and that only Congress would control the monetary unit of the United States. So it was doubly unconstitutional at its outset, and it's become more unconstitutional every day since.
Is there any gold left in Fort Knox?
No one knows. I worked with a man named Edward Durrell who spent quite a fortune of his own, probably $100 million, trying to prove that there was no gold in Fort Knox. And apparently he finally was able to prove it, but they never published the fact that it's not there. And they had a number of congressmen go to Fort Knox, and they led them deep into the bowels of the earth, about 50 floors down in elevators. And there they were shown, through iron cages, they were shown some stacks of what were supposed to be gold bars. And they said, that's the gold stock of the United States. But the congressmen were not allowed to go into the, past the gold bars, the bars of the gold bars. And they were not allowed to, I think they were, they finally extricated one gold bar and handed it to them, and they more or less could see there was gold, which you cannot determine except by a chemical assay. And so a congressman was handed a gold bar, and he agreed this is the entire gold stock of the United States. And that is the only acknowledgement that we have gold in Fort Knox.
What is the difference between a gold or silver-backed currency as opposed to a fiat currency?
Well, fiat currency is paper currency, which is backed by paper money, which is what the Federal Reserve dollar is. And I say in my book that Congress in 1944, during World War II, when the American people were occupied with the war and so forth, Congress in 1944 hurriedly passed a law removing the last gold and silver from the backing of the U.S. dollar. So since 1944, the U.S. dollar has been a paper-backed money issued against paper bonds. It's paper on paper. So that's the status today. The United States dollar is more or less the trading currency of the entire world, and it's totally worthless. Has no backing of any kind.
What's wrong with paper or money?
Well, You can take a Federal Reserve dollar bill and go to any store in the United States and buy a dollar's worth of goods. And so it's worth a dollar. It's accepted as a dollar. But it's accepted, credit means I believe. So that means that any merchant who accepts a Federal Reserve dollar says, I believe that this is a real dollar. That's all there is to it. It's still a piece of paper, green paper, which is worth what any green paper is. You can figure yourself. You can take a sheet of green paper and you can clip out $800, $100 bills.
So monopoly money is
monopoly money. It's the same as the game Monopoly.
What's wrong with central banks?
You have to understand that all the settlers who came to the America, including my ancestor William Mullins, were fleeing European oppression. And this oppression was primarily government officials working for private banks who were oppressing the people, charging them too much interest to usury, and taking their homes and property because they didn't have enough cash to pay off the debt. And so people finally fed up and set sail for the United States to get away from this. So, of course, every settler who came to the United States was totally against banks because they were running away from banks. That's why they came here. So obviously they did not welcome the idea of setting up banks on U.S. soil. They were firmly opposed to it. And Charles Lindbergh capitalized on that sentiment of the American people when he led the fight in Congress against the Federal Reserve System in 1913. And his son, Charles Lindbergh Jr., became a very famous aviator and a world figure, and his entire public career, he never mentioned the Federal Reserve, which his father gave up his political career for. So he was run out of Congress because he voted against the Federal Reserve System. Every congressman who voted against the Federal Reserve System in 1913 was run out of Congress the following year. New York banks sent in somebody to run against him, and they were lavishly financed with printing press money, and they put him right out of office. And there's never been, since 1914, anyone in Congress, except one or two isolated instances, we've never had anyone in Washington who would criticize the Federal Reserve System. Just as on television, you never have a radio program which will criticize the Federal Reserve System. Of course, you have three competing networks there who are ostensibly economic rivals, and very dedicated rivals, and yet they totally agree on everything like the Federal Reserve System and foreign policy and so forth. We've got to defeat Hitler, and we've got to defeat communism. We've got to defeat Nazism. Well, if you ask the average man in the street in the 1940s if he wants to defeat communism, he says yes, because his newspapers and his politicians tell him we've got to defeat communism. At the very time of the Cold War with communism, the United States taxpayer was totally financing the Soviet Union, which had been insolvent since 1917 and which had been maintained by the United States taxpayer ever since. And Woodrow Wilson, who was born about three blocks from where we're sitting, initiated this system of financing the Soviet Union in 1917, when he voted, Congress voted him a special emergency war fund of $100 million, which at that time was the same as about $1 trillion at that time, to prosecute the war against Germany. And he took $10 million of that, one-tenth of it, and sent it to Russia to help the Bolsheviks in Russia. And there were no Bolsheviks in the United States Congress. So why did the U.S. Congress authorize him to send them $10 million? Well, they've been doing it ever since.
What is that reason?
Because bankers consider communism and dictatorship as a good investment. A banker considers a dictatorship as a perfect government because everybody is totally controlled. And if anybody objects to paying high taxes or to paying debts, you can put them in a concentration camp or execute them, which Stalin did in Russia, and which is the perfect system. No banker will ever tell you this. Well, David Rockefeller did during the 1940s. He said the reason he was so pro-communist at that time was because the communists collected their debts at the point of a gun, which he didn't say, but that's why they do it. And that is why dictatorship remains the ideal of all bankers.
What is the main mission of the Federal Reserve System today?
Well, my book, The World Order, goes into that quite extensively, which unfortunately is out of print. But I found out when I wrote that book that the main mission of the banks was to start wars. And I found out also that it is very difficult to start a war. If you want to start a war with Iraq, go out and try to do it. It's very tough. And it takes years of hard work. So Bush had a great advantage because his father was head of the Central Intelligence Agency and a worldwide drug distribution operation. So he had plenty of money and plenty of political influence. He had no problem at all to walk into Iraq, although Iraq had never fired a shot at the United States. You see, you declare war on another country when they invade your country and try to take your territory. There has to be some very good reason to have a war, because you can understand that it's very difficult to get millions of people to run out and kill each other when they have absolutely no bone of contention whatsoever. In fact, all the wars have had... See, Ezra, that's why Ezra got into this entire thing, and that's how he got me into it. He was living in Paris during World War I, and he had many young writers and artist friends who were drafted into the armies, and some were for Germany and some were for France, and they were killed. And he couldn't understand how these great talents, very brilliant young men, died for nothing. And when he spent years of studying the situation in 8 languages all over Europe, he found out that bankers make wars to create debt. And that's the only reason. And that's the only reason. We went to war against Germany in World War I and World War II at a time when by census, 52% of the population of the United States was of German origin. So this was like a civil war. The bankers, the central banks of Europe, and they couldn't have World War I. They'd been wanting World War I since 1885. But the central banks of Europe had already bankrupted every country in Europe. And it was impossible to have a war. They didn't have enough money. There wasn't a country in Europe, England, France, Germany, Russia, there wasn't a country in Europe which could finance one day's war anywhere. So that's why they were conspiring in the United States to get the Federal Reserve System passed, because the Federal Reserve System was conjured up simply to make World War I possible. Without the Federal Reserve, there would never have been a World War I. No American would ever have died in World War I. So you can say they were murdered by the bankers, because that was the only reason they were there.
So you say that they don't start the war, but they conspire to make it happen? I mean,
they make it happen, yes.
How do they do that? I mean,
well, they do that through worldwide conspiracies, through Masonic and other secret brotherhoods all over the world, which operate as criminal conspiracies, the Mafia, the Masons, and the Jesuits, and so forth. There are always these underground groups which are very profitable. When you get into one of those things, you get into very profitable situations. And when you're in one of these organizations, you become very wealthy yourself. Yeah. Al Capone became one of the richest people in the United States. And he complained to the newspaper men. He said, "I'm just like any other businessman." And he was. All businessmen were like him, but they wouldn't admit it.
Is the United States government a corporate banking criminal enterprise?
Well, it's a conglomerate of various criminal enterprises. There are many criminal enterprises in the United States. Some are quite large and some are quite small.
But the government a criminal enterprise?
Always a criminal enterprise. Because the elections are completely staged and manipulated from the beginning to the end. The candidates are chosen through a very careful process of someone who will thoroughly agree with anything they want to do, foreign policy and economic policy. There are two ways you govern a country, and that's through economic policy and foreign policy. Because as far as a country itself, it's a limited operation. The United States is limited to the borders of this country.
Is the U.S. monetary system controlled by the Bank of England?
Oh, yes, it is. I say that in my book. The subtitle of my book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, is The London Connection, in which I prove conclusively that London still runs the United States. See, London is still the world market of the world bankers, not Washington, not New York, and not Tokyo, and not Berlin, but it's London. George Bush went public after I published this book. It had been published for almost a year, and I'd sold maybe 100 copies because I never advertised my books. They were never reviewed. Nobody paid attention to it. And George Bush Sr. was president at that time, and in November of whatever year it was, he started going on the television and talking about the New World Order. And of course, the only book on the World Order is my book. So I sold out immediately, which was very disconcerting because I have no publishing company and I had to go and print another edition. And so it's out of print again right now. But people are begging for copies. In fact, they sell copies on the internet for very large sums because it's the only book.
What is the World Order?
The World Order is a conglomeration of people who agree on the same goals and they run the world.
So it's a conspiracy of
bankers and politicians and political leaders, and it's mostly very... Well, it's what is loosely known as capitalists. And a capitalist is not a person who makes capital. He's a person who has capital, and he can make investments. That's what a capitalist is. And he makes investments that make money, more money. And that's all capitalism is. You invest in things that make more money than you have already. So when H.L. Hunt was the richest man in the world, he was buying whole radio networks. In fact, I helped him set up a television network, and he was going to have his own television network. At that time, there were still three networks, and he was going to set up a fourth because he had so much money that there was no problem for him at all to set up a television network. And it's a good thing for him he didn't do it because he would have been murdered if he had started his own television network. He wouldn't have lived 6 months because that is real power. They didn't care how much money he made, that he was the richest man in the world, but it's when you take over the levers of power that you become dangerous. And when he had his own television network, he could have ruled the whole world. So he would have been killed, there's no question about it.
Why is it that people don't seem to care?
Well, in the 1930s, scientists wondered how Hitler could rule Germany and Stalin could rule Russia. These were vast territories. He could rule them with practically no army. And the answer was they had discovered during the 1920s that adding sodium fluoride to the drinking water made the people very passive. Stalin found out that in his concentration camps, where you have to have guards, I mean nobody's there because they want to be, that by adding sodium fluoride to the drinking water to camps, or the gulags, he could reduce his guards by an average of four. You only need one in four, 25% instead of 100%, which comes to quite a bit of money. Sodium fluoride is a byproduct of the manufacture of aluminum, which is a very complicated, well, you have it in Florida. It's a very complicated manufacturing process. And a byproduct of the manufacture of aluminum is sodium fluoride, which is a very dangerous chemical and is very expensive to dispose of. So somebody came up with the imaginative premise that maybe sodium fluoride could be used to add to water, and maybe it would help prevent cavities in children in their teeth. There was never any study conducted on this, and no proof whatsoever that this was true. But Congress, with the judicious application of bribes, passed a bill enacting sodium fluoride addition to water supplies all the United States. And we haven't had a revolution since. And we had one party government ever since.
Why did America get involved in World War II?
Well, it was inevitable because World War II was simply a rerun of World War I, exactly the same cast of characters. And in fact, it was the same person, Colonel Mandel House, whose father was a Rothschild agent during the Civil War. And so the senior House managed to have runners, privateers, bring cotton from the South to the British mills so that they could operate during the Civil War. So he made a lot of money, of course. And at the end of the Civil War, Colonel House was the only person in the state of Texas who had any money. So he took over the entire Democratic Party in the southern states, which were occupied territory, and still are. You still have two political parties in the South. They're called the Carpetbaggers and the Scalawags. The Carpetbaggers are the Republicans, and the Scalawags are the Democrats. And you have exactly the same government that you have had in martial law in 1865, with the same people running everything. It's a perfect setup, because everybody knows each other, everybody agrees with each other. There hasn't been a political contest in any southern state since 1865.
Is there a difference between carpetbaggers and scallywags?
Well, there is a difference. The difference is in the name. One group calls themselves Republicans, and the other calls Democrats. The Republicans are not Republicans, and the Democrats are not Democrats. As I say, they're carpetbaggers and scallywags, but they're not known. The press doesn't use those terms because it's offensive to some people. Some people would be offended by that.
Was the United States ever really a true republic?
I don't know that we were. I really do not. Because the people who rewrote we started off with the Articles of Confederation. See, that's where the Confederacy comes from. Because when the southern states seceded from the Union, they were exercising the prerogative which they had been given during the Articles of Confederation. To secede at any time. You see, the Articles of Confederation gave every state complete autonomy over its own power, over its own people. And so the southern states in 1860 decided to secede from the Union, which they had a perfect right to do. But in 1787, they rewrote the Articles of Confederation, and it was actually a secret convention of Masons in Philadelphia, and they rewrote the Constitution to create a federal government, mainly for the borrowing power. The bankers wanted a country which could have a borrowing power and which could pay back the money. And that was not possible under the Articles of Confederation. The United States colonies, when they won the American Revolution, they set up a governing document called the Articles of Confederation of the United States of America. And that was our sole constitution. But then these Masons got together in 1787 and said, we need an instrument of federal power, and we need an instrument able to borrow money and repay it. And that's why they rewrote the Articles of Confederation, and that's why they did it in secret, because they didn't dare tell anybody that that's what they wanted to do, to set up a dictatorial federal power, which the Supreme Court was invented to maintain federal power. The Supreme Court always says that the rule of law is the United States. Well, the rule of law is simply the rule of bandits who will control the United States. That is the rule of law. And if you violate that law, you'll be killed.
Where are the Articles of Confederation located?
No, the Articles of Confederation, I have never seen a copy of it. It's hidden somewhere if any copies exist.
Who wrote the federal government has no power over any citizen of the United States?
That's for me. I'm the only one who said that.
What is that? Where did that come from?
Well, that's the Betrayal of the Constitution. That's my latest book, the last book I wrote. And I simply said in there that the general welfare of the United States, Roosevelt, the Supreme Court passed his Social Security bill and all of his other bills under a false premise that the general welfare of the United States provides for this. Well, what it actually says is that the government shall provide for the general welfare of the United States, which upheld the original Articles of Confederation, which said that each state has complete autonomy. And therefore, the bill for the general welfare of the United States is the bill upholding the Articles of Confederation. But they've perverted that the Constitution says that you have to uphold the general welfare of the states, which is what it says. And all of the government programs for citizens are totally illegal because only a state has the power over a citizen. The Washington government has no power. The Washington government is in the seat of government, which is Washington, D.C., and it only has authority in the 24 square miles of the District of Columbia. It has no power on any state in the United States. That is why Governor George Wallace of Alabama threatened to arrest FBI agents who were creating revolution in the state of Alabama, which he had every legal right to do as a governor of the state of Alabama, because Washington had no power to send an FBI agent into the state of Alabama without Governor George Wallace's permission, which they didn't have.
Is the dictatorship of the federal government the reason George W. Bush is in office today?
Oh, yes. That was simply a plebiscite, actually, just like Hitler had in Germany in 1945. In fact, the Bush family has very deep ties to Nazi Germany. Oh, yes. Well, in fact, the United States government in Washington has carried out many of Hitler's policies, which he was unable to do because he didn't rule long enough. He had on his plans to bomb the nation of Yugoslavia before he attacked Russia, because he knew that he had to knock off the Slavic population in Yugoslavia before he would be able to attack Russia. And so he launched an attack against Yugoslavia, and time ran out on him on June 4th, 1944, when he attacked, on June 42 it may have been, when he attacked Russia. He had to attack then, although he had not yet subdued Yugoslavia. And so a loyal Nazi named President Bill Clinton finally carried out Hitler's plan of attacking Yugoslavia, and he bombed it into oblivion. That was carrying out the original Nazi program, because certainly the people of Arkansas, where Clinton was from, had no interest in bombing Yugoslavia. And I could give you many parallels of government action in the last 25 years, which is carrying out the policies of Adolf Hitler.
Who financed Hitler's war?
A good friend of mine, Tony Sutton, wrote a book called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and he wrote a second book called Wall Street and the Rise of Bolshevism, which are out of print now. Tony's dead, but the books are absolutely authentic, and he absolutely proves that every step of Nazism was financed by Wall Street bankers, and every step of communism was financed by Wall Street bankers.
And the Wall Street bankers are tied into international money lenders?
Well, they're tied into the consortium of central bankers of the entire world. the Bank of Italy, the Bank of Japan. And so, well, these are people who've learned to work together, so they do very well.
How is the Bush family tied into World War II?
Well, I always have to start my lectures on Bush by pointing out that the Bush family itself has no background at all. The Bush family was had worked for the Harriman family, and Jacob Schiff at Kuhn Loeb Company, which I mentioned earlier, he financed John D. Rockefeller in the Standard Oil in New Jersey, which became the world oil monopoly. And he financed the Harriman brothers in the Northern Pacific Railroad, which developed the whole western half of the United States with tremendous property rights along the right-of-way of that railroad, which made it probably the richest corporation in the country. And so the Harrimans, of course, made billions of dollars, and they, as really wealthy people did, they had to have somebody to finance, to handle their money. So they hired a young couple, a young family, the Bush family, who were Wall Street operators. They became their money managers. And that's all they did, was manage money for the Harriman family. And so, by the way, Averell Harriman became a world agent for the bankers, and his exploits were memorialized in a series of books by Sinclair Lewis, who was a very popular novelist in the 1930s, about an invented character. He called him Lanny Budd. And this was a very wealthy young man who traveled around the world on a first-hand knowledge of world leaders. He was welcomed into their offices and directed policy for them. And Averell Harriman actually wound up, from 1942 to 1944, Stalin had a nervous breakdown when Hitler invaded Germany, and they had to send Averell Harriman as the world agent of the world bankers to Moscow as ostensibly as U.S. ambassador, and he went into Russia and was the actual dictator of Russia from 1942 to 1944 because Stalin was totally immobilized by his nervous breakdown. And so the whole World War II would have collapsed if Averell Harriman hadn't gone in and kept it going by running Russia from behind the scenes. And of course, at that time, Russia was fighting Nazi Germany. So theoretically, Averell Harriman and the United States were Nazi Germany's biggest enemies. And finally, the Russian army didn't sweep through Germany and conquer Hitler, but that was done through Averell Harriman. There was nothing that Stalin accomplished whatsoever, but nobody knows that. But this is the connection of the Harrimans with Hitler. They actually defeated Hitler, but what they did, they laid Germany waste and it became an American colony, our colony of the world bankers, and has been occupied territory ever since. Both Germany and Italy, Germany and Japan, have been totally occupied countries since 1945.
Can you talk about your book, The $5 Trillion Cold War Hoax?
Well, the $5 Trillion Cold War Hoax was exposed by Norman Podhoretz, who's one of the big Zionist propagandists in the United States. He was the editor of Commentary in New York City of the American Jewish Committee, which was the unofficial Bible of world Zionism. Commentary carried very serious articles by respected writers on economic and political things. It was like the Foreign Relations Council on Foreign Relations publication, Foreign Affairs. These were the Bibles of people in the State Department and in Congress to read. They had to read these articles to know what was to do. And that's how they got their instructions. And so anyway, Norman Podhoretz published his autobiography a few years after the Cold War. And he stated in his autobiography, which was for the elite, of course, the average person would never read it, he stated very quite frankly that the only purpose of the Cold War was to arm Israel to fight the Arab nations. We're in Iraq today because Podhoretz armed Israel in the 1940s, 50s. See, all this came out of the Paris Peace Conference at Versailles in 1919. There's a book called 1919, Paris and Versailles. And that's a very important book. It tells you everything that was done at the Versailles Peace Conference. And one of the main things was a very vigorous Zionist conference at the World Peace Conference in 1919. And the Zionists got everything they wanted, including Woodrow Wilson, who was a very ardent Zionist himself. So he put Brandeis, who was the head of the World Zionist Organization, which was a very powerful position, he put him on the Supreme Court of the United States. And that's when Wilson put Brandeis on the Supreme Court, that is when the Supreme Court became the operating instrument of the world conspiracy right there. And it's been that ever since. And that's why they voted to put George Bush in the presidency, because they'll do anything that they're told to do.
Could George Bush be indicted for war crimes?
It's more or less disinformation. There is no indictment. There's no indictment going to be handed down. And all of these things are simply making George Bush more secure in office. He's almost ready to become president for life because there's no opposition whatsoever. The Democrats have been totally shattered. They have not a single candidate. And I don't know what they're going to do. And the Republicans don't even have a candidate. They're talking about McCain, who's the biggest phony in the United States. He's married to a mafia princess in Arizona. And he's rolling in money. And he has all the prestige in the world. And he has 100% media cooperation. You would think he's Frank Sinatra, because the media swoons every time McCain appears anywhere.
Could Zionists make George Bush a so-called leader for life?
Well, I think it could happen very easily, because we've elected puppets ever since 1900, when the bankers really took control. Well, he's got advisors who could change that very easily and then could know exactly how to do it. There's certainly certain regulations you'd have to follow, and you could make him president for life. Don't forget, Napoleon made himself emperor for life. Napoleon was a complete nobody. You got to remember that the American people are drinking fluoridated water every day, so they can't object to anything. It's very easy to do, because 9/11 was a step in the right direction, and they can repeat 9/11 at any time, like the Murray Building bombing in Oklahoma City, and the Waco Holocaust of burning a church, an entire church congregation alive in their own church, which Hitler never did in his worst years, but we welcomed it in this country. The CIA will support any dissident group, no matter how far out you are. If I had started a religious group or a political group at any time during the last 50 years of my career, I would have immediately gotten CIA support.
What do you mean support?
Financial support and political support. You'd be allowed to operate. And the FBI would not come in and shut you down tomorrow morning, because that is only done by orders from Washington. Well, they like to have fringe groups all over the country of any persuasion. They really don't care what you believe or what you do, as long as you do something. They're used to manipulate the population, because some people are going to be very enthusiastic about whatever goofy thing these people espouse, and other people are going to be fiercely opposed to it. So right away you've got opposition and conflict right away, which is just handed to you on a silver platter. You don't have to do anything. All you do is turn these people loose and have them attack each other, and you got a war on your hands.
Do you think the Zionists are planning a war in the United States?
Oh, yes. Well, what I think is that they're having problems right now, because the fluoridation of the water and the medical establishment has made the children in schools so passive, and the working people so passive, that they don't object to anything. They didn't even, there was no opposition at all to going to war in Iraq, which was the flimsiest thing we've ever done in the history of this country, because Saddam Hussein had never fired a shot in this country, and he had never posed any threat to the United States of America. There was not one American in the United States who was afraid of Saddam Hussein. And our army goes marching into Iraq and pulls down his statues and throws him into prison. And they have a problem with trying him, which is that he had been a loyal asset of the CIA for 40 years. And it's hard to get rid of one of your most faithful officials over a number of years. He didn't just appear on the scene 2 years ago. He's got a 40-year history with the CIA, which most of the employees don't even have.
I mean, what's it all about?
Well, all of the foreign policy organizations in the world, at the end of World War I, the Rothschilds organized a number of groups called, one was the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. It's called Chatham House. And that is the think tank of all of Europe today. And although its headquarters in London, the real headquarters are in Brussels, which is the headquarters of the Lambert family, which is part of the Rothschild family. And there, Brussels has been running the world since, you know, we had an ambassador to NATO for many years, because NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was headquartered in Brussels. And of course, there's no coincidence that it was headquartered in Brussels, the headquarters of the Lambert family, which is part of the Rothschild family. It was simply a family company.
Who do international bankers support for their control?
NATO and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs are all very heavily financed. And if you become affiliated with them in some minor capacity, you'll have an annual salary of, say, $100,000, unlimited expense account to travel around the world on missions and stay at the most expensive hotels, and charge accounts at the most expensive shops to buy your clothes and so forth. And in other words, you become part of the international elite, and you live like a millionaire. Whether you have a dime of your own or not, it doesn't matter. And they will pay all these expenses until you make one mistake. If you give one wrong interview or say the wrong thing publicly, why, your history, that's your last day. And no one will ever hear of you again. And that happens quite frequently.
What do the corporate bankers have to hide?
What they've got to hide is their affiliation and control of all these foreign policy organizations. See, we have the Foreign Policy Institute and Foreign Affairs, the think tank magazine of the World Policy Organization. And all these are very expensive operations. And so they're all run by very trusted and faithful employees, and they do their job every day. They're at the office every day. They don't run out on you. They don't rat on you or anything. They're dependable. And they have that job for as long as they live, and they know that. So they do their jobs, and they do whatever they're told. It doesn't matter how goofy it is. You can do something as goofy as invading Iraq on the basis of information about WMDs that do not exist, weapons of mass destruction, and get away with it, because these people are accustomed to doing really goofy things that nobody in their right mind would believe in 1 minute. And they're very serious about it, and they have the background. They are people like president of Harvard University or president of Yale University. They use a lot of corporate presidents, like the Aluminum Company of America president, and people like that, General Motors president, who have stature, and they can do or say anything, and nobody challenges them whatsoever. And that's what reputations are for. They're for people they can use. For instance, I've been a world-known author for 50 years, and yet my name is almost completely unknown, except it's all over the Internet, because on the Internet, they have no control. But in the world media, on television, you'll never see me on television, because I've told people repeatedly that when you see anybody's face appear on your television, that means that that person is totally safe and totally owned by the establishment.
Who controls the United States government today?
Well, it's a conglomerate of various criminal enterprises. There are many criminal enterprises in the United States. Some are quite large and some are quite small.
but is the government a criminal enterprise?
Always a criminal enterprise, because the elections are completely staged and manipulated from the beginning to the end. The candidates are chosen through a very careful process of someone who will thoroughly agree with anything they want to do, foreign policy and economic policy. There are two ways you govern a country, and that's through economic policy and foreign policy.
Is the Federal Reserve controlled by the Bank of England?
Oh, yes, it is. I say that in my book. The subtitle of my book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, is The London Connection, in which I prove conclusively that London still runs the United States. See, London is still the world market of the world bankers. Not Washington, not New York, and not Tokyo, and not Berlin, but it's London.
What's the main mission of the international money lenders?
Well, my book, The World Order, goes into that quite extensively, which unfortunately is out of print. But I found out when I wrote that book that the main mission of the banks was to start wars. And I found out also that it is very difficult to start a war. If you want to start a war with Iraq, go ahead and try to do it. It's very tough. And it takes years of hard work. So Bush had a great advantage because his father was head of the Central Intelligence Agency and a worldwide drug distribution operation. So he had plenty of money and plenty of political influence. He had no problem at all to walk into Iraq, although Iraq had never fired a shot at the United States. You see, you declare war on another country when they invade your country and try to take your territory. There has to be some very good reason to have a war, because you can understand that it's very difficult to get millions of people to run out and kill each other when they have absolutely no bone of contention whatsoever. In fact, all the wars have had... See, Ezra, that's why Ezra got into this entire thing, and that's how he got me into it. He was living in Paris during World War I, and he had many young writers and artist friends who were drafted into the armies, and some were for Germany and some were for France, and they were killed. And he couldn't understand how these great talents, very brilliant young men, died for nothing. And when he spent years of studying the situation in 8 languages all over Europe, he found out that bankers make wars to create debt. And that's the only reason. And that's the only reason. We went to war against Germany in World War I and World War II at a time when by census, 52% of the population of the United States was of German origin. So this was like a civil war.
Amazing.
In fact, the Constitutional Convention failed by one vote to make German the official language of the United States in the 1780, because it missed by one vote, because the predominant population of the country was German. Although it was settled by the English and the French, the English and the French were both too aristocratic to go and live in a desert, a wild country like the United States. And so when Rothschild hired the Hessian troops to battle the American colonists, who were English colonists, and King George III realized that the American colonists would not fight against their British brothers, who were troops from George III from England. And so he had to go to Germany and hire the Hessian troops, who were mercenary troops. And the payment for that rent of these troops became the Rothschild was the agent for that. That was his first start towards world power. He made so much money out of the Hessian troops. So there was another consequence. All of these German troops declined to return to Germany because they had a whole continent here that they had their pick of. Why should they go back to Germany, where every inch of land was owned by somebody already, and you could only get it if you bought it, and it was very expensive. And they could stay in the United States and have 1,000 acres of very good land for nothing. So, of course, they all stayed. I mean, you can't beat a bargain like that anywhere.
Does Israel control the foreign policy of the United States?
Israel completely controls the United States. In fact, Ariel Sharon, president of Israel, has said that repeatedly, publicly. It's very seldom picked up by the press. But he says the United States will do anything we tell them to. Not ask them to, but tell them to. When Zionism was first proposed in the early 1920s, you see, during World War I, they got the Balfour Declaration for a national home for Israel, and that was pushed through the British Parliament by Lord Rothschild. And because it was such a raw deal, because nobody in the world wanted a national home for the Jews, particularly the Jews, because they lived very well as a parasitic people all over the world, and they didn't particularly look forward to the idea of being confined to one country, which of course they never have done. And so most of your prominent Jews, including Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb Company, who bankrolled the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, Jacob Schiff from 1920 to 1926 was an outspoken anti-Zionist. He believed that it would be suicidal for the Jewish people to have a national home, which of course they would have to be loyal to, as opposed to the freedom that they enjoyed, which was to be a citizen of every nation in the world, which was ideal for what they wanted to do.
Can Zionists destroy the world?
The Zionists have brought the world to the brink of total destruction, economic and natural resources and everything else. You see the skyrocketing price of oil and the skyrocketing price of real estate in the United States. This is a activity which can't go on at this pace long in a few weeks more, and everything's going to totally collapse. So wiser heads, of which are very few, realize that you can't keep going like this. But the bankers and the people who are making the money wanted to keep going like this, because when you're making trillions of dollars, you don't want to quit. It's an addiction. And so they'll keep letting this go on a few more months and see what turns up. There is a revolution going on in the world today, which is actually the world turning. As the world turns, it goes to a certain phase and another phase and another phase. And that's where we are now. Everything is changing, but we can't see it, because it's not a day-to-day change. But there is. Well, the Internet was one example, because under the Internet, people like myself, which have all media totally closed, television, newspapers, and yet I've become an internationally known writer just by doing it myself. It can be done. So things are not static. Things are less static than they've ever been. And I look for, right now, you see, you have a new generation coming up every 20 years. And that new generation wants to make itself felt. They want to make its presence known. And so every 20 years, you're facing an utter revolution, because the 20-year generation, many of them from wealthy families, are from prominent families, and have some stature in themselves, and many others are totally penniless and have no background whatsoever. But they create a place for themselves. I started my own publishing company because they told me on Wall Street that they couldn't print my book because the banks would close them down on Monday morning. So I found a child psychologist who would publish my Federal Reserve book. So it can be done. And the publishing media and communications are advancing at a very breathless rate. So you don't know what they're coming up with in the next 6 months. Don't forget, they put a bill through Congress to control the Internet, and it was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, because it was totally unconstitutional. There was no justification for it forever. The Supreme Court represents the occupation government, because the government is always an occupation government representing somebody else. The government does not represent the American people, because the democracy is supposed to be representative government. Now, Washington today does not represent any American, except in a very tenuous way.
Was 9/11 an inside job?
100%. What I called it publicly, I was quoted in the New York Times after 9/11, I said it's a typical government operation. And I don't know anybody that said it better. And that appeared in the New York Times in the Frank Rich column, and Frank Rich printed it, but he didn't offer any rebuttal.
Is it a United States government job, or is it a Zionist inside job?
Well, it's more a Zionist inside job.
Okay.
Because the Zionism is the government in Washington. Everybody knows that.
So the United States government is controlled by Zionists.
Yes. Well, in Congress, have you ever heard any congressman stand up and make a speech denouncing Israel? Well, you won't.
With that said, and these bankers know that, you know, their time can be limited,
yes,
no matter how much money they got, what would they be capable of?
Well, right now they're capable of staying on top of the current, and they have enough money to buy into anything they want to. So they're trying to keep control. But of course, they have no control over the Internet. Anything can come on the Internet. And so they're just trying to ride it out. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion are a very debated document which appeared in the 19th century. And supposedly, it's a program by which the Zionists were going to take over the world. The techniques that they would use to do this, by controlling communications and education and governments and so forth. And it's a very detailed program for exercising power. And so this document was immediately denounced, and the Zionists denied that it ever existed and so forth. But it was finally brought before a court in Basel, Switzerland, and a judge ruled that the Elders of Protocol of Zion was a forgery. And of course, a forgery is an illegitimate copy, an unauthorized copy of a real document. So the judge's ruling that the Protocols of Elders of Zion was a forgery established that there was a real document somewhere called the Elders of Protocols of Zion, although none was produced. And so ever since then, whenever you mention the Elders of Protocols of Zion, they say, well, that was ruled a forgery by the court in Switzerland. And it was ruled a forgery, which meant that it was a copy of a document that it existed somewhere. I mean, when you forge a check for $100, there has to be an original check somewhere for $100 that you forged. So the Elders of Protocols of Zion is the same thing. The fact that the court ruled that there was such a document meant that there is such a document somewhere and is eventually produced. Henry Ford was the most famous publisher of the Elders of Protocols of Zion, although it's been published in millions of copies ever since 1870. And the reason that Henry Ford published this, as you know, he was an automobile maker, and the fact is he was a very successful manufacturer of automobiles. And because he was so successful, he became the richest man in the world in 1927. The New York Times named him as the richest man in the world. Well, as the richest man in the world, he became fair game. So bankers set about trying to buy control of his stock and control of his company. And he needed capital to expand. He was expanding so rapidly, he needed a lot of capital. He needed hundreds of millions of dollars to keep his motor car company going, or to sell it to somebody else. So he tried to borrow the money from Kuhn Loeb and the Wall Street bankers, and they told him they'd be glad to lend him the money, but they wanted controlling interest. In other words, he had to give away the company. It would no longer be his. So he was very indignant about that because he was a Michigan farmer, and he didn't like being robbed. And so he began to publish articles about these the Jewish bankers had tried to rob him, And he made a crusade out of it. He launched a newspaper called The International Jew, which became a series of books, which I think were 9 volumes, which told the background of the Jews as white slavers. They were very active in slavery. They brought slavery to America. And their adventures in alcohol, they were behind the... after Prohibition, they became the biggest liquor manufacturers in the world. Most of it was cheap whiskey, which was cut with raw alcohol, which blinded hundreds of people and killed many thousands more. And it was typical of their operations, because killing people wholesale seems to be a get-rich-quick idea, that if you can kill thousands of people, you're going to be very rich. My friend Ernst Sandl is in prison today in Germany. He's finally been charged after about 8 years of being imprisoned before they ever leveled a charge against him. And so the charge is inciting racial hatred. And Ernst Sandl has never been a member of any group which incites racial hatred. So he'll probably never be tried, because that's what happened to Ezra Pound. He was imprisoned in St. Elizabeth's under a capital charge of treason, punishable by the death penalty, but they never dared try him, because when they called him in and said, Dr. Pound, because he was a doctor of letters from Hamilton College, how do you plan to defend yourselves on these charges? And Ezra said to them, I will stand behind everything that I've ever publicly uttered on politics. And they were devastated, because he had too big a reputation, a worldwide reputation, to be tried when he would demolish every argument they came up with. So they got 3 government psychiatrists to testify that he was incompetent to participate in his own defense, because he said he had stand by everything he had said. So these psychiatrists said he was incompetent to participate in his own defense, and they held him in prison for 13.5 years, and I was told on Capitol Hill that he would never be released in his lifetime. I was told that by General Lucius Clay and by Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark and 2 other leading officials in Washington, because I had personal connections with them, and I didn't talk to them myself, but George Simpson, the founder of National Press Club, said, well, I'll ask around about Ezra what his chances are. And he came back and reported to me that they all said he will never be released from St. Elizabeth's in his lifetime. And 8 years later, the government dropped all charges against him, and he walked out a free man.
Why was Ernest Sandl deported?
Well, he was a Holocaust denier. They've called me a Holocaust denier also, although I have never denied there was a Holocaust, because I've never even admitted there was one. So,
do you think there was?
Well, there was no Holocaust. You see, Hitler... Now, I'm the only person that apparently knows this, and I speak about it very freely. In the waning wars of World War II, when the Allies started to bomb Germany very heavily, Hitler moved all of the Jews out of German cities into rural areas in these camps. And so no Jew died during the Allied bombing of Germany. And that was he was holding them as a bargaining tool, because he knew he was going to lose the war, so he could negotiate the terms of surrender by the fact that he had saved the Jews from extermination. So now he's known for the fact that he exterminated the Jews.
So the Zionists flipped all this around?
Oh, they flip everything around.
In their favor.
For the name hatemonger, which they've called me many times, and... a hatemonger is a person who criticizes Israel. That's all that matters. That's the only definition of a hatemonger.
Is there a difference between a Jew and an Israeli?
Oh, no. Because the Jews are the occupants of Israeli. Although the Palestinians live there, it was originally their land, but they were dispossessed, and so they're not considered as existing. Palestinians have no rights, according to Israel.
I think according to Israel, nobody has rights but Jews.
Well, they have a perfect claim, because they say God gave them a real estate deed to the property. and which they refused to show anybody, but it's considered valid.
Are the Jews God's chosen people?
Well, that occurs in the Old Testament. I don't know how often, but the Old Testament also contains many pages of denunciations of the Jews by the God and threats to punish them for their transgressions. It's about 50-50. There's more verbiage in the Old Testament of God denouncing the Jews and threatening the Jews than there is of calling them his chosen people.
Well, what's the difference between a Christian and a Jew?
Theoretically, biologically, we're the same people. We're human beings.
Right.
Well, the Jewish people, according to my book, The New History of the Jews, the Hebrews got their name from H-A-B-I-R-U, Habiru. And Habiru meant bandits in the Old Testament. So these people were known as bandits all over the Middle East. But the Jews have their own book, which is called the Talmud. And in the Talmud, which is the Jewish Bible, they continually denounce Mary as a whore and a prostitute, and Jesus as a madman, and sometimes as a homosexual. And so it's totally anti-Christian. But they've never bothered to explain any of these accusations. But they're rabbis studying this for all their lives. So they apparently conclude that it's absolutely true, and there's no apology for using those terms. And of course, a billion Christians who have some belief in Christianity resent this very much about Mary and Jesus being all these foul names. So this is done simply to keep passion stirred up between the various religions.
Is the CIA controlled by Zionists?
Well, my book, The World Order, has the only history of the CIA. I went through at least six histories of the CIA, which were between 800 and 1,000 pages apiece. And from that, I got the entire history of the CIA. And I have it all in 10 pages in my book, The World Order. I'm sorry I don't have one with me. But as I say, this so-called friend carried off a copy about a month ago. I told him, I said, this is my print copy. I got to reprint this book. And he said, I'll get it back to you in a week. And I haven't heard from him in 3 weeks.
Tell me about that. How does that start in your book, and where does it go?
Well, I give the entire history of the CIA, which was formed in 1940 in London by the British General Staff. And the chief architect of the CIA, which was established as a branch of the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, of England, which was established by the Bank of England in 1694 and became the best intelligence service in the United States because it had unlimited funds because that was financed by the Bank of England. It was simply a private intelligence agency for the Bank of England, just like the FBI is a private intelligence agency of the Federal Reserve System. When they had the Ruby Ridge Massacre in Idaho, I was traveling there and lecturing at that time. And so I did a talk show, and there was a young interviewer who was asking me about this, and I said, he said, well, what about all these police units that are attacking Ruby Ridge? And I said, those police units are all Federal Reserve police units. And he said, there's no such thing as a Federal Reserve police. And I said, they're all Federal Reserve police. Who do you think pays them? And he cut me off. It's the only time I've ever been cut off on a talk show in my life. The thing went dead.
Do you think people just don't want to know, or they just think, or what?
Well, when you tell them the real facts, they don't want to admit it. And so the only thing is to hang up the phone.
Or attack you.
And, all right, well, they do that constantly. Once they hang up on you, whenever your name is mentioned, if somebody says, why don't you have Eustace Mullins on? They say, listen, I had him on Adnut on this program, and he practically wrecked my whole program. And that's true. I've taken 50 talk shows hosts off the air in the last 50 years. Never with any intention to do so, but I would say more on the air than they wanted their audiences to hear. And so they would close down the show rather than risk having somebody like me appear on the program again.
Is Mossad connected to the CIA?
It's part of the same operation. In fact, Mossad is generally credited with being totally behind 9/11, and that that was a Mossad operation, that they had a squad of Mossad people on hand at the time it happened. And the New York Times and the New York New York Post both printed stories after 9/11 that 85% of the Muslim world believed that it was a Mossad operation. When 85% of people believe anything, it's worth noticing. But the New York Times printed this to show how insane the Muslims are. And it kind of backfired. It gave legitimacy to what they were saying. Well, if you said that 85% of the people in the United States believe something, then you would have to pay attention to that. And in fact, most all government programs of the last 50 years have been openly opposed by 85% to 89% of the American people. So what do we have except an occupation government? Because when we have a government which is approved by 10% of the people, something is wrong.
You said that Zionists were on hand during 9/11. Where were they?
They were in the buildings around there. They were directing operations, and they were filming, and they were recording, because they wanted a record of this situation. And so there are many stories, I mean pictures, of the buildings being hit by these airplanes, which people have never seen those pictures because they're concealed. But they'll tell you a lot more what actually happened if you're able to see those pictures.
So why do you suppose that Israel wanted to take out the World Trade Centers?
Well, Larry Selberstein bought the World Trade Center, biggest office buildings in the world. He bought it in July, a couple of months before this operation. And it was heavily insured. And, of course, when he just bought it, he just made a down payment. So he owed most of the money on it. So when the buildings were collapsed by demolition, which is the only way a building can come down like that, is controlled demolition. Because you can't knock down a 100-story building just by wishing it away. You have to have it takes about 3 months to plan all the electronics and the demolition. And so this, at 9/11, the building sank gracefully, the way they do under any standard demolition operation that you've ever seen.
What's the point? What was the point in them taking the building down?
Well, it changed the world. That was the point.
How so?
Well, the papers said that our world has changed forever and never be the same, which is a very remarkable goal. Just by blowing up two office buildings, you change the world.
What did they get out of it?
Well, they got, first of all, national panic. Second, total government control. And the war on terror, which will go on forever, because we're going to be terrified forever. So we'll always be... there'll always be terror. Terror is the most wonderful thing. I wrote an article, which is on my website, called The Necessity for State Terrorism, in which I conducted an imaginary interview with Joseph Stalin, in which he explained why state terrorism was necessary. And you know, the Bolsheviks, for 70 years, they killed an average of 1 million people a year, which is 70 million people. And that was done without a peep from anybody. Nobody has ever been charged with a single murder. You can kill a million people a year, and there's no blame attached to anybody. Look at this last attack in London. They put a little bomb in a little...
Who did?
Well, I don't know. Supposedly Muslims did. But it looks like a standard Mossad operation. Because I don't know why any Muslims wants to bomb the London subways, because they ride it to work every day.
Okay, so Israel attacked the United States on 9/11.
Yes.
They got Iraqi oil.
Yeah.
They got. They're going to have Iran oil.
Yes.
They're going to have Syrian oil.
And Saudi Arabia.
And we kind of got that now, but in a kind of roundabout way.
Well, Saudi Arabia apparently has been playing a double game all the way, because the Saudi princes have always banked their money in Switzerland, apparently with Jewish banks. So the so-called Saudi billions are apparently completely controlled in Switzerland by Jewish bankers. The central bank mechanism has enabled the Jews to control all the banks of the world, because central banking is just that, centralized banking. That's all central bank means, that it's centralized banking. And if it's centralized, the Jews can come in from anywhere in the world and gain control of it.
So they control through debt.
Yeah, through debt. Well, control through debt means control through unpayable debt. It's debt that can never be paid. The interest will never catch up with the debt itself.
So is that what they did to the United States government? Is that how they're controlling it?
Oh, yes.
So the United States government went and borrowed money for wars, and now it can never be paid back, so they're under the control of the...
Well, that's why you had the big spenders, starting with 1933 with Roosevelt. You had big spenders ever since, because the more spenders you have, the more debt you have, the more interest the banks make. It's a win-win proposition.
For bankers.
And it's a ruinous proposition for any nation in the world. As I pointed out, since 1885, the Rothschilds were trying to start a world war, because the Zionist International Congress at Basel, Switzerland, has called for three world wars. At the end of the Third World War, they would control the entire world.
At the end of the Third World War?
Which we are now.
Are we in World War III now?
Well, I just filed a court paper in which I pointed out that a billion Christians are fighting a war to the death against a billion Muslims, which will leave Israel in charge of the world, which was predicted at the 6th International Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, in 1896. They had a speaker there who said, we're going to have three world wars. And in 1896, there had never been a world war. So after the Zionist Congress in 1896, you had World War I, World War II, and now we have World War III. Jewish people feel like they can be safe only if they control the world, because they have developed a mythology throughout the world that no matter where a Jew goes, he's going to be killed by somebody, and that everybody hates Jews and everybody wants to kill them. Well, you won't find that. In the United States, we have provided a haven for Jewish people from all over the world for 400 years. There's never been a pogrom, which is a Jewish name for attacks against Jews. There's never been a pogrom in the United States in 400 years, yet we have multi-million dollar organizations like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which claim that there's enormous activity anti-Semitic throughout the United States, and that Jews are in an immediate peril of annihilation here. And this is pure mythology. There's no basis for it whatsoever. But on the basis of this mythology, they raise hundreds of millions of dollars of taxing as that money in the United States. And the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Bureau of Investigation both completely back this program of illegal money raising for a fake organization. And they all should be in prison for it.
Well, why do you suppose that Jewish people are so paranoid?
Well, because that's part of their religion. Because from the beginning in the new history of the Jews, I point out that they have always believed in ritual human sacrifice, and this has caused objections everywhere they've lived. And it's their own practices which bring down retribution on them. It's not because anybody hates Jews. I don't think you hate Jews.
I don't hate Jews at all.
And I don't hate Jews because I have no reason to hate Jews.
Why do they hate us?
Well, because we're in the way.
Of what?
Of their world power. They want world power, and the only way they can the only way they can obtain world power is to get rid of us.
So then we're talking a major war.
Oh, yes, eventually. The thing is that when you talk about a major war, you have to realize that most people don't care one way or the other about the Jews. So how could you have a major war about Jews? Well, the answer is they manipulate people, because we've had two world wars, and we're at World War III at the present time. Well, how did these three world wars come about? By manipulation. We marched into the desert in Iraq, which was part of the old Ottoman Empire. There's no such thing as an Arab country, because they were Turkish provinces for many years. And so we're fighting in Iraq for a country that didn't exist before 1919, and that's becoming a major World War III between Muslims and Christians.
Who are the terrorists?
Anyone who opposes Israel is a terrorist. That's where the word originated. We never heard of terrorists 50 years ago.
Who considers you to be an anti-Semite?
The Jewish people consider Ezra Pound and myself as the real anti-Semites. They must be attacked and denounced every time the name is mentioned. When I published the Federal Reserve book in 1953, over 50 years ago, the book was immediately attacked publicly by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the same people who got me discharged from the staff of the Library of Congress, the only person ever discharged from the staff of the Library of Congress for political reasons in its entire history, because usually people at the Library of Congress are not politically active, and I was not politically active. I had never voted in an election at the time that I was fired from the Library of Congress. So that shows you what an activist I am.
Do you think that they are going to stage another 9/11 event?
Oh, they almost have to. It has to be something further. I've said for a year, at least a year, that they've got to have another 9/11. And I don't know what they're going to do.